We're back with another episode of The Short Stacks, our shorter conversations with authors about their process and their books. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas. Our guest today is award-winning novelist Miriam Taves, author of 8 books, including All My Puny Sorrows and A Complicated Kindness. Today, we'll be discussing her most recent book, Women Talking. But before we get to that conversation, here's a little housekeeping. Today's episode of The Short Stacks is brought to you by Audible. Audible is an audio database that offers hundreds of thousands of audiobooks. For folks who are new to Audible, get your free 30-day trial and free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. If you want even more of The Stacks, join The Stacks Pack over on Patreon. You can help support the show, engage with bookish friends, partake in our virtual book club, have a say in the books we cover on the show, and much more. So head to patreon.com/thestacks. That's patreon.com/thestacks. You can always send your support our way by going to paypal.me/thestackspod. Before we dive into today's episode of The Short Stacks, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you listen and leave us a rating and a review, especially if you're listening through Apple Podcasts. Okay, our guest today is Miriam Taves, a Canadian novelist. We're talking about Taves' newest release, Women Talking, which was inspired by true events that took place in the mid to late 2000s, where women of a Mennonite colony were drugged and raped in their sleep by men of their community. As Taves says in the book, quote, "Women Talking is both a reaction through fiction to these true life events and an act of female imagination." I'll let Miriam take it from here. Okay, Miriam, thank you so much for being here on The Stacks with us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So we're going to just dive in. The first thing I'm going to ask you is, in about 30 seconds or less, can you tell us about your book?
Between 2000 and 2005, 2009, there were rapes, attacks occurring in the Manitoba Mennonite colony in Bolivia. When the women finally started talking about them, they weren't believed. They were blamed. And this is an ultra-conservative closed colony. And so the book is about, it's an imagined response to these attacks.
Amazing. That was really good. Why did you feel compelled to tell this story?
Well, when I first heard about these rapes, I was as horrified as anybody else. There were rumors going around in the Mennonite community here in North America, especially here in Canada. And I was enraged. I was saddened. I was horrified. But I also had so many questions, questions that I feel that I've been attempting to answer, or at least come closer to understanding in my work over the years, and now sort of reaching ahead with the knowledge and awareness of these crimes. So questions about the culture, my community of Mennonites, that it's a patriarchal community, authoritarian, fundamentalist, with the misogyny therein, the inherent misogyny of that. And I just wanted to, we can see the consequences of these types of things, this culture of control, especially, when we see these types of attacks happening. So I had questions about these things and that I wanted to explore in my writing, and I wanted to have the women from the colony, my fictional characters, ask themselves and each other these questions.
Yes. I mean, I feel like that's, to hear you say that is really interesting, because that's like, when I was reading the book, I thought, wow, she's really grappling like with these ideas, and it's kind of a complex, and there's lots of layers and there's lots of questions, you know, like about forgiveness and about whose right it is to be in control of what things, and, you know, all of that stuff. And I kind of feel like parts of this book feel like your own personal, perhaps that's overstepping, but your own meditations and thoughts on these ideas. And I kind of was wondering why you chose to write a novel as opposed to a collection of essays, or kind of in my fantasy mind, like a play, because this really mm-hmm. felt like a play, like a one room theatrical moment. So I don't know what it was for you that was like, I'm going to do this as a novel.
Mm-hmm. I guess, I'm a novelist, so
right.
it's always, no, but it's a good question, because, like you say, it's I've written a sort of, it's an unusual format, and in that you're right. I mean, it does read like a play in a sense that there's so much dialogue, and it is like the title suggests. Women talking for the most part, but not entirely. I wanted to write a novel about it. I wanted to be able to, you know, use fiction for what it's so good at, which is getting to, you know, certain truths that nonfiction can't. And within that context, of the sort of novel format with August Epp, the narrator, coming in and out with his own experiences, his kind of parallel life, and reasons for being there. I guess all of those things, the voices of the women, the chorus of the collective voice of the women, were just things that I thought work better within the novel. And to be perfectly honest with you, I have written one or two essays in my life, but it's not a form that I'm I really feel I know. I don't know how to write an essay.
That's so interesting. I'm always fascinated with authors' own perceptions of themselves and their writing, because I don't write. I just love to read. And so in my mind, I'm like, oh, if you can write a novel, you could write an essay, you could write a play. Like, so it's fun to hear you say, like, I don't really do that.
I don't really, you know, I've never, I would love to be a poet. I mean, for me, poetry is just the, you know, the purest, you know, and I've tried to write poetry, and I know that it's just awful and should never, ever, you know, be shown or to anybody, and even the short story, I mean, it's its own art form, you know? Yeah. So I know it is an interesting thing whatever brains we have as, you know, as writers, that we're somehow drawn or compelled to, you know, but there are writers who kind of cross all sorts of, you know, boundaries and are very versatile, but unfortunately I'm not one of them.
Well, you just think you're not one of them. Maybe one day you will be, and you'll be like, I remember years ago, I thought I could only write a novel, and then you're going to be like poet laureate or something. Yeah, we'll see. We'll touch back in. So one of the things in Women Talking, it's a big book as far as like what you're grappling with. Like, it's big ideas, you know, it's very heady stuff, but the way that you approach it, and it's not big, like it's not that long, but the way that you approach it feels really intimate. And in addition to that, you have a lot of funny comedy. Like, there are parts where I kind of like chuckled to myself, some of the lines, some of the moments. And so I'm kind of wondering how you approach balancing these big issues about, you know, forgiveness and rape and male authority with kind of these smaller, more intimate moments, and how you approach that kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is, I think in a way it is a kind of unconscious or subconscious kind of thing. It's that way, like, I guess that rhythm of the darker, more serious or philosophical, you know, the kind of combination, almost like chorus, verse, it's almost, you know, in my mind, I guess I could, although music is another thing that I can't do, but in my mind, I can think of the novel as having a kind of musical rhythm in a sense, and with a pacing and with an in and out of the darker. All along, though, I mean, like the you know, the tension in the loft where the women are talking, is there. It's pervasive. They're terrified. They're suffering. They've been violated. They've been harmed. They've been, you know, so, and that pain that they're carrying, in so many different ways, psychically, physically, spiritually, is always there. But then the need, I think, for me anyway, as a writer, and maybe for the reader as well, to sort of then kind of move away a little bit, in tone, and get to a lighter moment is again, you know, what I think of, I guess, as a kind of rhythm, as a rhythm that's, you know, that you can enter into more easily as the reader and the writer too, to keep that going, so that it's not necessarily the comic moments or the lighter stuff isn't necessarily a break or a change, it's not meant to be a distraction from the serious nature of what the women are discussing and attempting to you know plan, but it's meant to it's just another way of showing these women as real human beings, because I think, you know, even in our dark times and in trauma, especially, I know from experience, you know, that idea, especially when you're with a group of people and people that you know, I mean, there is that tendency to be drawn towards laughter or a kind of collective sighing of relief that might, you know, take the form of a joke or comedy or an amusing anecdote or even a kind of physical gag, you know, like the teenagers in the loft, you know, in the book who mime all sorts of things because they're bored to death and stuff. But so, yeah. So again, sorry, I'm rambling, but again, it's the idea of creating a kind of gentle and then not so gentle rhythm in and out of verse and chorus in a way, if I can compare it to music.
Yeah, no, definitely. I wonder a little bit about the narrator or the person through who we see the story, which is August, who's a man. And I'm sure this is something that you, you know, thought about and figured out, but why did you decide to have a male be our entry point into the story?
Mm-hmm. There are many reasons. First of all, he can read and write. The women, he's left the colony. He's educated. He left the colony because his family was kicked out of the colony for, you know, sort of ridiculous but perceived sins, crimes within the colony, which basically consisted of trying to educate children. And he himself is a teacher. Anyway, so he's been away. He's lived in England, and he knows how to read and write. And the women don't. They're illiterate, for essentially, and so just out of pure necessity, if the book is the minutes of these meetings, then they would need somebody who knew how to write to take the minutes. But more importantly, you know, August is he is suffering as well. He's also a victim of that culture, though not, of course, to the same degree that the women are. He's still a man. He's still entitled. He's suffering, and Ona, the woman that he is in love with, although in his own kind of unexpressed way, expressed but unexpressed, she senses this at the beginning of the book. She senses that he is suffering, that in fact he's suicidal, that he's so close to taking his own life and to succumbing to that kind of despair that he embodies. And so she says, in an act of compassion and love and for August, you know, hey, August, just, you know, come with us, women. We're going to be having these meetings. You come join us. You'll be safe with us. And at least you'll be alive, you know, while you're with us, at least. And we'll give you this task. You know, you know how to write, you have a fancy education, you were, you know, so you can write down, you can bear witness, essentially to what we're saying. And so in my mind, I mean, the women are the philosophers. They're, you know, it's an inversion of roles. He's there, he's the secretary, he's there to listen, to learn and to record. And I like that role, reversal and how, in a way, I mean, August inhabits, maybe it's heavy handed to say all men, but in that it's time now for women to do the talking, for men to do the listening and the learning. And in the end, too, I mean, the minutes are irrelevant, you know, the women don't need them. They'll go on to, you know, they'll go on to write their own stories. And they have more urgent, important things to take care of. And August is left, you know, basically, at the end, you know, wondering, he asks himself how will I live without these women? In a sense, they've given him life and they've given him a type of education.
Right. When you were writing this book, what sort of stuff were you, Miriam, reading, watching, listening to, either for inspiration or escape or research, or just kind of what was in your mind as you're doing this process?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a good question. What was I reading when I was, I'm trying to think. I mean, I was reading a lot of Rachel Cusk, probably. I was reading some, you know, I don't know, probably Bolaño, Roberto Bolaño, a writer whom I admire very much. It's been dead for a while. I was reading Virginia Woolf, which I turn to on a regular basis for inspiration. But it's hard to remember. Mm-hmm. As you know, I was reading the Bible. Mm-hmm. I was reading work by other Mennonites about the culture, with the Mennonites have the same questions that I have. I was listening to my mother. I was listening to the sounds of my mother is a devout Mennonite church going person, and she lives here with Eric and me, with my partner. She lives on the main floor of the house, and we're on the second floor of the house. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when her friends come over, I was listening to the way they talk, the way they pray together and sing together and express themselves and connect and reconnect. There was so much. There was so much going on. But of course, I finished writing the book in 2016 or 2000, mm-hmm. at the very end of 2016. So, so it's a little bit difficult for me now. So many books and along the way that it's hard for me to
remember.
I remember I was reading Joy Williams at the time too, who I think is brilliant.
Mm. This book came out originally in Canada first, correct? Or no?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's what I thought. Correct. So I do have a question a little bit about the way that the book looks, like the cover. When you publish a book in somewhere else in Canada, and then it gets published down the line in America, do you have say in like the second printing, like the international printing, or is that all through your publisher?
I do have a bit of a say. Yeah, definitely. Here in Canada, all the covers of my books, I've always, they're usually some designs are sent to me and possible covers and I'll have some thoughts and often those are respected and that's great. Sometimes publishers will just have, you know, the designs that they want because of they know their audiences, their readers better. And for instance, I don't know, Italy or France or wherever, you know, so, but certainly here in Canada, I have a lot of, input. And, I find that with this book, with Women Talking, there's so many different beautiful, covers that, you know, and so they're so different one from the other.
Yeah.
I really love them all. I've really been lucky with the covers.
I do have a question a little bit about your family. So you mentioned your mom, and I did a little research on you, not a ton, a little bit. I like to know a little. And her maiden name is the same as one of the families of women in the book. So I'm wondering, do you name your characters after family or friends? Or in this case, was that intentional? Or is that just a very common Mennonite last name?
All those things. It was intentional. It's a very common Mennonite last name. But my mother's name is Lowen or Laven, pronounced with this, you know, similarly to Taves, the O-E-W, but it Lowen, Laven. And her mother's maiden name was Friesen, actually. And that's the other family in the book. So I used those two maiden names of my grandmother and my mother, and it felt good to me to do that. It felt right, and certainly the women, the characters themselves, are all based or inspired by the Mennonite women that I know, my family, my mother, grandmother, sister, you know, and friends. Definitely, it helped me to know who they are in my mind, and so in order to characterize them, I guess.
Right. And I guess you've written a lot of books, and how does it change for you as an author from writing like your first two or three to now, is this seven or eight for you?
Eight. Yeah.
So like you're a seasoned author, like you're author with a capital A. what's different? What's the hardest part about, you know, being a professional author versus someone who's like, this is my debut and this is something new for me and it's all fresh and exciting?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny that you mentioned that because, I mean, there was just nothing freer, no time. You know, when I was writing my first book, and this was 450 years ago in my 20s, and the freedom of that, you know, with nothing, no precedent, nothing had come before, you know, I had no right. hope that it would actually ever see the light of day. So I felt this incredible freedom, and joy and, you know, without the voices and the, you know, without feeling that I needed to, I don't know, and that was the freest time. And when I was, you know, when somebody wanted to publish it, it was honestly the most exciting, strangest moment in my life. I, you know, in my career, I mean, in my writing career, I couldn't believe it. It was just so, so exciting. And since then, you know, there've been, you know, with the books, every time is fresh, is new, is terrifying. I always think after I couldn't write a book that I didn't want to write. You know, you feel that people maybe want to read something that's similar to what they read before. But, you know, it's hard to sustain interest in a novel, writing a novel. If you're writing it for somebody, you know, else, really, if it's not the novel that you want to be writing or the thing that you want to be writing. So, I would tell myself, I do tell myself, this is the best that I can do. This is the only thing that I can write based on my experiences and at this point in my life. And it's an imperfect offering, of course, always will be. But it's the only thing that I can do. So in that way, I can, you know, there's that sort of psychological kind of talking to oneself before the writing. But certainly it was easier in a way. At the beginning, you know, I guess as some of my books have become, better known or the response has been greater, that's so gratifying. And to have that connection with readers and to have that conversation, even right. though it's not literally necessarily a conversation, but it's amazing. But it's also, it's easy to fall into a position where you, or a kind of frame of mind where you start to really doubt, you know, yourself and I wonder maybe I should stop. Right? I always feel after every book that this is it. It's just too hard on me. It's too, I can't do it. Maybe I'm just lazy, but.
What would you do if you stopped being an author?
Exactly.
Do you have a dream? Do you have something else?
No. And now I'm far too old to start, you know, so now I'm stuck. I have to, no, and I want to write again. I need to keep writing. I'll have to write, you know, I'm an unhealthy person if I'm not writing in every way. So I'll have to, you know, I'll continue to do it. But, I don't know what I would do if I didn't write. I fantasize about it, you know, maybe like driving around, driving around. But how can I, you know, I guess a cab driver, I could be, but or a bus driver, tour bus driver. I would love to be a tour bus driver.
Well, I think we can make that happen if you're serious.
I am serious.
Get your resume out there.
I love road trips. I love long. I would, somewhere in the desert, you know, if I could. Drive a tour bus in a desert with friendly people who good tunes, you know.
This is also sounds like a book to me, just so you know. Kind of a fun little romp.
Anyway, as you can see, I'm sorry, I'm rambling on about other things besides writing. As you can see, I'm in that place where I'm fantasizing.
Yes, it's okay. I love a fantasy. Well, tell me about your writing process a little bit. Where do you write? Like, what do you have music playing? Are you eating a snack? Do you have a beverage you drink? Do you light a candle? Like, what is your, it's writing time?
Mm-hmm. I light a candle, especially this last book. I started doing that when I was writing Women Talking. I lit a candle every day. I meditate a little bit beforehand, especially with this book, thinking of the women, thinking of the real women, praying. I pray, which is, you know, surprises even me. I haven't prayed in so long. And whether it's meditation or whether it's prayer, whatever it is, it's thinking, it's mindfulness, you know, the word of the day, but thinking and asking for guidance and attempting to telling myself, you know, write as honestly and as intelligently as you possibly can, and you know, think of and take on the suffering. I mean, there's this line that I read in a book, you know, my suffering is the world's suffering, you know, my suffering is the world's suffering, which is so beautiful in a way. I mean, it helps to put one's own suffering for what it's worth or lack thereof into perspective, and that, you know, to live is to suffer. Some of us, including these women in Bolivia, have suffered a great deal and more than I ever will. But to put oneself in that headspace, you know, requires a kind of thinking before the actual writing. And so that's a little bit of a process, at the beginning, and lighting a candle. And, I don't listen to music and, I would get too busy in my head if I were to listen to music. And no, I don't eat snacks, but I do drink a lot of coffee. I eat a lot of snacks when I'm not writing, just not during the writing process.
Got it. How long did it take you to write this book?
It didn't. I spent so long thinking about it and taking notes and reading. Like I said, I heard about the rapes around 2009, and immediately began to think, you know, I knew that I felt that I wanted and needed to write about this in some way. I didn't know exactly how. I knew that I didn't want to reenact the rapes. Right. That's not what I was interested in doing. And so, you know, and then other things happened. My sister became very sick. She was suffering from depression, and she took her own life in 2010. And after that, and she and I spent a lot of time talking about these rapes and talking about Mennonite culture, and how, you know, what we had experienced in these particular communities, in our own conservative Mennonite community, and she was instrumental in kind of helping me to figure out how I was going to go forward in this. Then she got very sick and she took her own life in 2010. And then everything stopped and writing. And when I finally did think again about wanting to write or being able to write again, I wanted to write about my sister, and I wanted to write about our relationship and her struggles and her life and her death and her illness and suicide. And so time passed, and then eventually, you know, this book, Women Talking, was always, you know, wasn't called Women Talking, obviously. It was just this thing and in the back of my mind. So when I actually started writing it, because it had lived inside of me for so long, and, you know, it didn't take a long, long time to write, and, you know, a year, but it was also so, it's such an intense experience, more intense an experience than any other writing experience I've ever had. And so I feel as though maybe the writing took on a little bit of the same urgency that the women's discussion in the loft took on. And therefore, I didn't have a lot of time. I felt things closing in. And, you know, whether that was some sort of sympathetic parallel experience, of course, not of the attacks themselves, but of that sense of time of urgency. But it didn't take that long. And I knew that I needed to finish it rather, quickly.
I love that it took that on for you. Was there any pushback that you've received on the book that either you felt was valid or that you were like, this is crap. I can't believe someone said that about my book, that sticks out in your mind on either side?
I mean, there are always, you know, there are always a certain group of conservative male Mennonites who have always attempted to discredit me, who are angry with me, who hate me, who would prefer that I was silent, didn't write the stuff that I write. That's always been the case. There are many, many, many supporters as well. Mennonite supporters, male and female, but a lot of women. And so, you know, that's kind of standard, mm-hmm. particularly with the women attempting to achieve agency, determine for themselves how they're going to live, what they're going to do, seem to anger, you know, particularly these conservative, you know, conservative types who feel threatened by that. And I don't think that that's confined to a Mennonite community. That's something that, you know, is happening and is ongoing, that we're, you know, struggling with forever. Maybe not forever. Hopefully not forever. Absolutely. Hopefully not forever. I think that was kind of, it's always disappointing. I always feel that, you know, why can't we be self-critical? Why can't we look at our community, you know, look at the problems within our community, you know, the problems that are a direct result of, you know, this hierarchy, the authoritarianism, fundamentalism, et cetera, isolationism. Right. And with it, you know, the self-governing thing where, you know, men act with impunity and entitlement and women are, you know, silenced, mm-hmm. voiceless, dehumanized over time, from day one and with no recourse. I mean, they can't leave these colonies and there's no outside, you know, they're trapped, they're prisoners. And why can't we look at that as a Mennonite, as a kind of, you know, collective Mennonite community and attempt to, you know, with respect, of course, for the faith, for religious freedom, for all of that, for tradition, absolutely. But with in mind, with, you know, taking care of our people, and giving voice to women and girls. Anyway, I mean, I'm, you know, rambling again, but there is always that. And I get tired of it. You know, I do get tired of it, but I'm used to it. And I always expect it.
Let me just say that I love your rambling. What you call rambling to me is like this the most divine, interesting stuff. So don't ever stop rambling. I really only have one more question for you, which is, for people who love Women Talking, what are other books that you think maybe are a good companion or in conversation with, or things that you might suggest feel similarly, even if it's not the same topic, but just things that you know that you're like, oh, if you like this, you might be interested in that.
That's a good question. That's a very good question. You know, in terms of the idea of women coming together and talking, I mean, there are writers who have been doing that forever, who continue to do it. Virginia Woolf, Rachel Cusk, for instance, Pat Barker, Joy Williams, Alice Munro, and Margaret Atwood. I mean, they're like, you know, that this idea of women speaking out, which again is so bizarrely threatening and terrifying to certain people. There are books that I'm thinking about too, like, for, you know, again, you know, Bolaño's stuff, which even though not necessarily directly about women speaking out, really not at all, but the combination of dealing with, looking at, writing, examining the kind of corruption that within power, you know, and the sinister evil, although I'm not sure I like the word evil, but the sinister aspect of, and that corruption within you know, government, nations, powerful organizations, and how that affects the individual, how it affects art, how it affects expression, and how it affects women's lives, and especially, particularly, not only women's lives, but especially women's lives. Mm-hmm. And even Nelson Algren, who I mentioned because there's a new biography of him. He's one of my favorite writers. He died a long time ago. And his stuff, maybe it's dated or something, I'm not sure, but I love his stuff. It's about the disenfranchised, the marginalized, the voiceless. And, you know, and again, not only women, but it's that idea of giving voice to people without a voice. So, I mean, there's so many writers.
Yeah. Well, Miriam, thank you so much. This was so great to talk to you and about your book, Women Talking, which is out now. I mean, it's been out, but now it's out in the States where I am. but thank you so much. Do you have anything else that you wanted to add before we go?
No, I think we covered it. Like I say, I rambled on. So that
in the best way, in the best way. Well, thank you so much. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you all so much for listening to The Short Stacks. And thank you to Miriam Taves for joining us. I also want to say thank you to Tara Kennedy and the folks over at Bloomsbury. You can purchase Women Talking now wherever you get your books. To help support The Stacks and earn awesome perks, go to patreon.com/thestacks or make one-time contributions at paypal.me/thestackspod. Make sure you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. Supporting our sponsors supports the show, so check out Audible and get a free 30-day trial and free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/thestacks. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music comes from Tegeurigis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas, and I will see you in the stacks.